come. So come. Come whoever you are. And we are, all of us, working on who we are. What is our blend today of hope and despair, of male and female, happiness, sadness, youth, age? So whoever you are today, come. Join us this morning for fellowship and learning and inspiration. Welcome to us all. There are announcements in the bulletin, which I neglected to pick up, even though it was offered to me. please pay attention to the announcements in the bulletin. The racial justice team, June Helping Hands, the home-cooked meals for the emergency shelter, and so on. Madalena will light the chalice while I read some words from Harry Meserve, a Unitarian minister in Massachusetts. It's in the form of a prayer. From arrogance, pompousness, and from thinking ourselves more important than we are, may some saving sense of humor liberate us. For allowing ourselves to ridicule the faith of others, may we be forgiven. From making war and calling it peace, from having special privilege and calling it justice, from being indifferent and calling it tolerance, from pollution and calling it progress, may we be cured. For telling ourselves and others that evil is inevitable, while good is impossible, may we stand corrected. God of our mixed up, tragic, aspiring, doubting, and insurgent lives, help us to be as good as in our hearts we have always wanted to be. So be it. Our opening song is number 109. This song is associated with textile workers in Massachusetts marching for fair wages and decent treatment. But that march echoes in the marches for women's votes, for civil rights, for gay pride, for action on climate change, for action against gun violence. So sing boldly, because there is still much that we may be called to march for. So number 109, as we come marching, marching. Please stand or sit as you feel comfortable. Thank you. Congregational singers. Well, I don't see very many children. There's one who is about. Well, a long, long time ago, back when wishes still came true, there was a little boy who did not always know the answers at school. His friends seemed to always know the answers. That wasn't true, but that's the way it seemed to him. And because he didn't know, he sometimes felt kind of dumb. He wasn't dumb, but he felt that way. And I'm old enough to know better, but I still feel dumb sometimes too. Anyway, one day that little boy wished, "I wish I was the smartest kid in the world." Well, he didn't feel any different. But the next day, he went to school. And the first class was arithmetic. And the teacher asked a hard question, and it may be too hard for you, but we'll see. How much is 2 plus 3? You're right. But you know what? The little boy didn't know the answer. The teacher then called on his friends. They didn't know the answer either. What do you think had happened? He was now the smartest kid in the world. And so none of the kids knew the answer. That little story just reminds us that we, when we wish for things, that we can get some surprises, okay? And so I wonder, if your wish could come true, what would you wish for? Any ideas? No? Well, actually, I was thinking at this point that I might even ask not only you and all the other little kids around here, but I might even ask the grown-ups for a couple of ideas of things that you'd wish for. Anybody have a...
Everybody have the compassion of the Buddha because you love every living thing. That would be cool. Everybody can love every living thing.
Compassion for every living thing. Anyone else want to venture a wish? Well, I'll tell you what... Was there somebody back there?
Peace. Peace. Oh. Peace in the world.
Peace. Thank you. Thank you. I'm an old man, you know. I don't hear so well. I thought about what I would wish for. And recognizing that things can go wrong, I still wished that there could be an end to unfairness. Because, you know, a lot of things in the world are unfair. When I was a little boy, I could go to the big library downtown and get out lots and lots of wonderful books. But little black kids could not. That wasn't fair. when I was older, one of my best friends in high school couldn't openly love the person he loved. That wasn't fair. And when things are unfair, that sometimes makes us angry that things are unfair. And so the grown-ups later today are going to sing a song about what happens, what you can do in the face of unfairness, unfairness that makes you angry, because one of the things that you can do, one of the things, is to be friends with the people who are being treated unfairly. That's what the grown-ups are going to sing about. They're going to sing about being fair to people of all races and people of all genders and sexual expressions. They're going to be singing about being fair. And that's what we want you to learn in our religious education program. When we sing you out, you know what we're hoping for? We are hoping that you will learn the principles and gain the inspiration to act, because wishing unfairness away isn't going to change anything, but acting can. And that's what we want you to learn to have the wisdom to do and the courage to do. So it's time to sing the children out. Love our hearts, go with you. Go and joy our hopes, go to. Shine your light in all you do. Go and love our hearts, go with you. Go and joy our hopes, go to. Learn and love, grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do. Our offertory this morning is going to be played by Emma Hubble. And let me remind you that this month our offering goes to Shepherd's Crossing. Yeah. Senior moment there. Goes to Shepherd's Crossing. So unless you otherwise designate the offering, it will go to Shepherd's Crossing this morning.
And I'll take Joseph. Thank you.
thank you so much, Emma, and we're really thankful that you stepped forward while Renee is on vacation. Very appreciated. The words of Frederick Gillis, spirit of community in which we share and find strength and common purpose. We turn our minds and hearts toward one another, seeking to bring into our circle of concern all who need our love and support. That is indeed part of why we gather together. This morning, Anna Franklin is thankful for the care and generosity of so many wonderful people in her life and assures us that love is alive and will survive and even thrive. We do have concerns, though. Jane tells us that our UU member, Margene Moss, is in the hospital for tests to determine the cause of anemia and shortness of breath. Margene had had a stroke about 2.5 years ago, and we haven't seen her much since then, but she remains in our hearts. Marissa Larson's neighbor took his life this week. He has 2 children, age 17 and 11, and the 11-year-old is one of Jake's best friends. So this family could use your thoughts, and so can Jake, as he tries to help his and support his friend. And finally, I have a few things from Sabrina. She has something strange that's happened to her left hand and has no strength, but will work to make it strong. She notes that July 6th is the Dalai Lama's birthday, the 14th Dalai Lama's birthday, and she sent him a card. So. And suggests emailing wishes to the Dalai Lama. And finally, she says this is a joy, but I think it's a joy, but it's a little bit of a sorrow to those of us who know her as well, that she's moving to Syracuse, New York, in 2 months. And if you want her to write you, give her your name and your full name and address, and she promises she will. We're part of a web of life that makes us one with all humanity, one with all the universe. We're grateful for the miracle of consciousness that we share, the consciousness that gives us the power to remember, to love, and to care.
I exercised the convener's prerogative to switch the order of the next 2 items. So our hymn of the month will be next. It's number 77, Seek Not Afar for Beauty. Now, this hymn speaks of several sources of beauty. You'll note them as you sing the words. But today, we think of additional sources of beauty. Beauty in a march for fair wages, beauty in an Arizona city whose mayor and fire chief welcome and provide care for asylum seekers and would-be immigrants. Beauty is indeed all around us. So, number 77, seek not afar for beauty.
Changing years unfold.
see it concealed. But in earth's common things it stands revealed. While grass and flowers and stars spell out the name. That is a pretty song. Our reading prior to John Alou's reflection is called Marginal Wisdom. It's a meditation by Leslie Takahashi, a UU minister in California, from her book, Becoming, A Spiritual Guide for Navigating Adulthood. Here is her meditation. They teach us to read in black and white. Truth is this, the rest false. You are whole or broken. Who you love is acceptable or not. Life tells its truth in many hues, but we are taught to think in either or. To believe the teachings of Jesus or Buddha. To believe in human potential or a power beyond a single will. We are taught, I am broken or I am powerful. Life, however, embraces multiple truths. Which I will find on the next page. We are taught to see in absolutes, good versus evil, male versus female, old versus young, gay versus straight. But let us see the fractions, the spectrum, the margins. Let us open our hearts to the complexity of our worlds. Let us make our lives sanctuaries to nurture our many identities. The day is coming when all will know that the rainbow world is more gorgeous than monochrome, that a river of identities can ebb and flow over static, stubborn rocks in its course, that the margins hold the center. John Alou.
The rainbow world is more gorgeous than monochrome, wrote Leslie Takahashi in the reading Larry offered. And that's what we celebrate with gay pride, isn't it? The music, the flashy drag queens, rainbows and sequins and feather boas and motorcycles and leather, a rainbow world more gorgeous than monochrome. The first gay pride, though, 50 years ago, the predecessor of all this gorgeousness, was different. It was gritty and seedy and messy. A riot, some call it, or a rebellion, an uprising. And particularly significant in it is what Takahashi says two lines later in the piece Larry read, the margins hold the center. What does she mean by that? Now, Leslie chairs the UU Commission on Institutional Change, the group that is examining our Association for Structural Racism. She understands that change doesn't come from the center where there is comfort and power. Womanist theologian Bell Hooks developed center-margin theory, describing how every group has people in the center with the most power and privilege, and those on the outskirts or the margins with the least power and privilege. And we all occupy different circles, sometimes simultaneously. And Hooks and Leslie Takahashi remind us that those on the margins are often unable to move toward the center. It's the people who are centered who can move out to the margins to help the needs of the most marginalized be met. And I'll come back to that. First, the story of Stonewall from 50 years ago this week. I've researched it fairly thoroughly, if not entirely methodically and objectively or scholarly. The truth of the past is much murkier than history books lead you to believe. There's so many reasons why that's true. Most of the stories, for example, with Stonewall, were carried in oral history before they were written down. And the oral histories have swirled together reality and the myth of the birth of the movement, not to mention their reliance on notoriously unreliable human memory. And people who were there have conflicting memories. Even the primary sources from the time do not agree. The police blotters and the mainstream press don't tell the same story as the Village Voice and the underground newspapers. It's a messiness that sounds and feels more real to me than the carefully constructed outlines that we read in history texts. So the setting, remember, 1969, first, the date. Do you know that in 1967, only 12% of Unitarian Universalists agreed with the statement, homosexuality should not be discouraged by laws or education? Only 12% of us agreed that we shouldn't discourage homosexuality in 1967, a world away from the times we have now. So that's the setting in time, the setting in place. What was the Stonewall Inn? It was an illegal gay bar run by the mafia. People who remember it then use words like sleazy, hellhole, and dump. The bar that exists now, called the Stonewall Inn, is altogether different. But consider who would be patronizing that dark, forbidding place in 1969. And remember, too, that it was illegal to serve liquor to gay people. That's right, illegal. A bar caught serving to people who were deemed disorderly, and gay people were automatically deemed disorderly, the bar could lose its liquor license. Members of the Mattachine Society, which was a forerunner to gay liberation, in 1966 had conducted sip-in protests in New York City bars. Like the sit-ins at lunch counters, they deliberately defied law and custom, notably at Julius's bar, which had been raided a few days before and didn't want more trouble. They would announce that they were gay. Well, probably they announced they were homosexual, and wait to be thrown out so that they could sue with the support of the ACLU. And the story about it in the New York Times was titled, Three Deviants Invite Exclusion by Bars. At first, their strategy failed, but eventually the Commission on Human Rights in New York decided that homosexual men, that's who had done the protest, had the right to drink in a bar. So the restrictions loosened a little. People felt a tiny bit safer. Still, gay bars were underground, more than a little outside the mainstream. And this continued for many years across the country. I remember the first gay bar I went to in the 1980s in Charleston, West Virginia, which had a nondescript front. And you could have gone by it and thought it was just a closed-down something. You had to enter off the back, off the street, where you couldn't be seen. And I can only imagine what 20 years earlier had been like, even in New York City. Now, so many of the bars, like the Stonewall Inn, were mafia-run. And there were other gay bars in the area, but many of them had cover charges and expensive drinks and were more discreet than the Stonewall. The Stonewall was known for its dance floor, flamboyant drag, watering down its drinks, and allowing in underage patrons. There was a culture of young, queer street people, many who had been thrown out of their homes across the country or had run away from them, and they converged in the Village. Many survived through sex work. And sadly, that same dynamic is still alive. It was something that we were trying to address in Oklahoma City when I was there, exploited kids who no one cared about, trying to make a way out of no way. back to 1969. Bar raids were a regular way of life. The mafia bribed the police, which didn't stop the raids, but sometimes they'd get a warning phone call or an orchestrated bust, being careful who was actually taken down. The mafia also shook down prominent people who wanted to keep their names out of arrest records, and they'd get advance warnings of the raids. The people at the Stonewall, though, were not the prominent people. The police had raided the Stonewall on Tuesday, June 24th, because it didn't have a proper liquor license. And the plan was for a second raid after midnight on Friday, so technically June the 28th. And the police hoped that that would shut the Stonewall down for good. The plan went awry in a big way. Eight undercover cops, including two women, entered and began arresting drag queens. Anyone who didn't have three items of gender-conforming clothing was considered in violation of an old masquerade law that remained in effect. So a man could be arrested for wearing a dress and tiara, a woman for wearing a men's three-piece suit. A main reason for the women among the plainclothes cops was to pat down and gender-check women. Gives a whole new meaning to enforced gender roles. Some of these folks at Stonewall were transgender, others transvestites, dressing as the opposite sex. The understandings of gender and sexuality were less nuanced in those times than they are today. Many of the people there were poor. Some lived on the streets. Some were sex workers. They were a mix of races. The raid went along as normally expected, the cops arresting or releasing people individually, one by one. And outside, a small crowd began to gather, mostly men and transgender people who had been released waiting for their friends. Until the cops rousted a particularly belligerent butch lesbian. Some say it was Stormé de Larvière, a mixed-race security guard and drag performer who appeared most often in zoot suits and black tie. Famous photographer of the marginalized, Diane Arbus, had shot Stormé earlier in the decade. So whether or not the butch was Stormé, she is said to have yelled at the crowd gathering, "What are you doing? Do something!" And before long, they did something. Who threw the first brick at Stonewall is a popular queer pastime. People suggest anyone from Stormé to trans activists Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera to pop icons like Madonna and Lady Gaga as a tribute to their queerness. You say they threw the first brick at Stonewall. And sometimes people use that to, cast aspersions on straight celebrities overplaying their gay appeal. Oh, they threw the first brick at Stonewall. There's even debate about whether bricks were actually thrown. Definitely things were thrown. Coins thrown at the cops represented the payola they took from the mafia. Bottles and drinks. Someone has talked about the shot glass heard around the world. Someone who was interviewed said, "I don't think I threw any bricks. Stones, yes." Paddy wagons and squad cars sped away loaded as chaos broke out. And somehow by 4 a.m., the police had barricaded themselves inside the bar for their own safety. Stonewall patrons and others who had joined the mob threw firebombs and tore a parking meter out of the sidewalk to use as a battering ram, and riot police arrived. A Stonewall survivor who goes by Miss Major described it this way: "The memory of that first night doesn't come to me with anything like joy or happiness because so many of the girls and a few guys got really hurt. After the city police barged into the bar with numbers and attitudes, the feeling that was so prevalent that night was fear. Looking at the riot squad was like watching Star Wars stormtroopers, but they were in black, with riot gear, sticks, guns, mace, helmets, and shields, The brutalization as they moved across and down the street was like a tidal wave hitting a coastline city. It just hit and rolled over you. If you fought, you'd wind up down, and if you were down, they would keep beating on you. The only pleasurable thing on that first night of the riot was watching the police get backed into the bar because they were afraid. And she was among those who were knocked out cold at one point. The crowds, fearing assault, would taunt and then run and circle back around the police. The New York Daily News headline the next day was, "Homo nest raided, queen bees are stinging mad." Much of the press coverage mocked the protesters, name-calling and misgendering. One right-wing account chalked the disturbance up to the funeral earlier on the 27th of Judy Garland. So maybe Judy Garland threw the first brick at Stonewall. Later, there would be protests even of the Village Voice for its homophobic and transphobic coverage. Though people finally went home that night, the disturbance didn't die. The next night, the Stonewall reopened, though not serving alcohol. A crowd showed up chanting slogans and gay power. Taunting of the police continued. And there were kick lines of queers singing, "We are the Stonewall girls, we wear our hair in curls." And then the lyrics get a little, well, anyway. Not your run-of-the-mill riot. Riot police broke it up, though, with tear gas and beatings. And only this year have the police apologized formally. And tensions around, there are continued tensions in the GBLT community around police. Should police be in the gay parade, pride parade, those kinds of issues. Here in Riley County, there's recently been two liaisons appointed to the gay community, which is interesting, because there's often a reluctance to accept policing. Anyway, it went on until after a few nights, the chaos dwindled. However, the spirit of rebellion did not. The Gay Liberation Front evolved out of the dust of Stonewall. More radical than existing homophile groups like Daughters of Bilitis and the Mattachine Society, who protested with neatly lettered signs and professional-looking gender-conforming outfits, the Gay Liberation Front directly attacked gender roles and the nuclear family, derided the capitalist system, and embraced the Black Panthers. GLF decided on the slogan "gay pride" over "gay power" because they weren't sure they had power, but they knew they had pride. One activist, Craig Schoonmaker, later said, "The poison was shame, and the antidote is pride." Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, both trans people of color who had been involved at Stonewall, also founded the Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, which of course spells STAR, and they worked to help homeless, queer youth, and sex workers in Manhattan. None of these groups, the Mattachine Society, Daughters of Bilitis, Gay Liberation Front, or STAR, exist today, but their legacy lives on in the many LGBTQIA+ organizations, community centers, university departments, youth groups, shelters, political, social, educational, legal, and religious groups, providing services, advocacy, support, and more. The first gay pride celebrations came in 1970 as a commemoration of the Stonewall Uprising. And 50 years later, these celebrations happen all across the U.S. and the world. The anti-capitalist agenda of the Gay Liberation Front has been entirely undermined by the commercial sponsorship of many of the parades and festivals, I think especially by beer companies, it seems like. Times have changed in unexpected ways. We have equal rights to marriage, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender elected officials, celebrity icons in the community, and though we're seeing some regression, the rejection of transgender people in the military, for example. The police do not arrest people anymore for being gay in a bar or for not wearing gender-conforming clothing. What do we take from Stonewall, though? What have we learned? Topmost on my list is that the people who have the least to lose, who are the most marginalized, are those most likely to rise up, and when they do it, they are not going to be polite or fair about it. The Stonewall patrons were not people of privilege in any way. They did not go about things politely. Though the more civil Mattachine Society had opened some doors, and actually the Mattachine Society posted some big notices, you know, people of our community, please calm down and quit rioting. But they had opened some doors. But the people who would be beaten and tear gassed were those at the farthest margins of society. Activist David Mixner says the more you had to lose, the less you were involved. The more you had to lose, the less you were involved. Tensions often exist in marginalized groups about how to go about gaining acceptance, a role, a place in society. And one way is to accept the parameters dictated by mainstream society and work within the system to be accepted. Follow the law, keep your nose clean, prove that you can do better and be better than anyone else. And usually the people who choose this route already have some power or privilege that they are building on. They trust, at least to some degree, that the system will take care of them and that their work and rational arguments can win the day. And we saw that in the Mattachine Society's sip-in and in the fight for marriage equality through the courts and ballot box. The other way, perhaps a way of desperation, or perhaps a way that simply disregards the current power stratification as illegitimate, is to simply dig in and resist, to go outside the system and build a new, more radical society. And I saw this tension reflected when I attended a Creating Change conference back in the early 2000s. The National LGBTQ Task Force has sponsored annual Creating Change conferences since 1988. And each year, the conference draws thousands of queer people to learn and strategize. If there is a gay agenda, it probably comes out of Creating Change. Anyway, at that time, the efforts of many organizations had turned toward marriage equality. And that was not the headliner for me, though. It was there at Creating Change that I heard heartbreaking testimony from young activists of color who were engaged with homeless queer youth in urban settings. They were telling about people dying. Teenagers without protection from exploitation, naive or cynical about AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases, homeless, often drug-addled, always poor. These young activists thought that money, time, and organizing energy would be better spent saving lives than getting the chance to marry and be legitimate. They were in the tradition of the Gay Liberation Front, of Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera. They were giving priority to those who are least valued among us, least visible among us, young people, often of color, usually more noticeable in their queerness, often transgender or gender fluid. Marriage, they felt, these young activists, was simply trying to buy into existing cultural expectations. They saw people who wanted to marry as selling out, really, trading true queer identity for acceptance by the wider culture. Now, I wouldn't take it quite that far, but their arguments, their passion, and their commitment to life resonated with me. Fatal violence continues to take lives, particularly of trans people, especially Black transgender women. The Human Rights Campaign cites at least 26 deaths in 2008, 18, and at least 11 violent deaths already this year. Dana Martin, Jocelyn Ware, Ashanti Carmen, Claire Legato, Malaysia Booker, Michelle Tamika Washington, Paris Cameron, Chanel Lindsay, Chanel Skurlock, Zoe Spears, and just a few days ago in Kansas City, Brooklyn Lindsay. There are also deaths that are suspicious, like that of Johanna Medina, who died after being released from ICE custody, and Laylene Polanco, found dead earlier this month in a cell at Rikers Island. The margins hold the center, wrote Leslie Takahashi. It could be that the people who are most marginalized, who suffer the worst indignity, make everything else possible. If it weren't for the refusal of people like Stormy Day Larvary, Miss Major, Marsha P. Johnson, and Sylvia Rivera to put up with the exploitation and violence of the police and the bar owners, would we have ever come as far as we have come? While we're celebrating Pride, we need to remember that there's still a long way to go, and that those who suffer more than others are those on the margins. Black queer transgender activist Raquel Willis wrote in an editorial in Out magazine, "If the gatekeepers of our community," and here she means the LGBTIQ plus community, and describes those gatekeepers as those powerful, mostly white, cis, able-bodied, wealthy, nonprofit directors, CEOs, and political insiders, "if they really believed in what our ancestors and transcestors at Stonewall were fighting for, we would see more elevating of grassroots black and brown leadership, the people who actually carry the torches lit by the founders of our movement. We would see more money going into efforts supporting those who are low income, incarcerated, homeless, and sex workers." Mind you, Sylvia, Marsha, and Miss Major lived these experiences. "We would see less of an interest in bringing on token queer and trans people, many who already have major platforms and little to no connection to the community throughout the rest of the year, in Pride campaigns to support organizations with million-dollar budgets that do work that never directly touches the most marginalized groups within our communities. This Pride Month, there's a lot to be mad about. There's a lot for us to riot over." In the presence of her testimony and that of what she calls our Stonewall ancestors and transcestors, I simply listen and learn and strive to give voice to what needs to be said. I have a little bit more, but I'm going to open it now to reflections, thoughts, questions that any of you all bring.
Susan Adamchak. Earlier this month, I visited friends and family in New Jersey, where I'm originally from. I mentioned this story a couple of nights ago at our Chalice Circle. And for the first time, I decided to travel around the state by train rather than renting a car. So on the Sunday that I was there, I went on one train to Newark and picked up another train to go down to the shore. You all know where the shore is, right? To stay with some friends. And as I was on the train platform in Newark, there were two African-American guys standing not too far away, wearing kilts and kind of heavy Doc Marten kind of boots and black vests, and they had lots of buttons on their vests. And I was a little perplexed because you don't often see black guys wearing kilts. And so I was kind of subtly standing there on the train platform trying to Google what was on their, you know, what I could read on there. So I didn't quite get anything, but I just kind of filed that away. And we get on the train, and these two men greet several other men who are on the train with studded collars and dog chain necklaces and T-shirts that were cut so that I could see their nipple piercings and things like this. Okay, this is interesting. And I go and I sit down in my seat, and in the seat next across from me is a man who proceeded to pull out his makeup case and spent the next 50 minutes making up his face before donning a rainbow afro wig. Well, I finally get the point that, in fact, there was a gay pride parade in Asbury Park that day, and everybody, many of the people on the train were heading there. At one point on the journey, you have to switch trains, and so all of us file out and file into another car. And I was just astonished and amazed and grateful and thinking of our theme of beauty this month to see so many people who were able to be there wearing their rainbow T-shirts, wearing their high heels, wearing all manner of clothing with nobody hassling them, with nobody staring. I mean, I did stare at the guy doing his makeup just because I thought I might get some tips. You know? But it was just an unbelievable experience. I had a gay uncle in my family, and it was something that was never talked about. You know, he was accepted, but I regret that he passed away before we had the opportunity to explore together more of what his experiences had been as a gay man. He had served in the army. He was in World War II during D-Day. He was a dress designer. He ran the gamut of breaking stereotypes. But that day on the train was so powerful for me and just so gratifying to be able to see brothers and sisters out there as they want to be.
Hello, Spring Boker. Have you ever heard of Cyndi Lauper's song, True Colors? I always love that song. Now, there is a campaign for homeless gay people called the True Color Campaign that's under Cyndi Lauper. And I just love the fact that, you know, when people say, I see your true colors, everybody thinks that's a bad thing. But I love the way she said, it's beautiful like a rainbow. And I just loved it to death. But there's a True Colors campaign. I'll probably contact them to see if there's anything going on in Syracuse. Maybe I can help out. But, yeah, I just love that song because you're beautiful. It's beautiful like a rainbow, and I just love that very much.
I just thought of this thing that happened in my family. You know, I spent most of my life in San Francisco, so the experience just makes me jealous because I miss Pride there. This weekend, there was a family member who lived with me for a long time, lived in our house with my family, and I grew up with him. And he was married and had a child. And then in the early 90s, he decided that he would reveal that he was homosexual, you know, however that happens. And he came to the family, and my father, he announced, I'm gay. And my father said, I don't know anybody who's gay. So he began his awakening and his growth right then, right there. Whenever it happens, take that opportunity.
Anna Franklin. I have a brother who's gay. And right about the time of Stonewall, which I knew nothing about. I was not keeping up with the news. I was 22. I was naive, whatever, you know. He came to visit me. He was in school in Beloit, Wisconsin. And he came for the purpose of telling me, I think I'm gay. And interestingly enough, I had good friends that were gay guys that were living together. You know, they weren't cross-dressing or anything. They were, if you saw them on the street, they're just normal guys, right? And I was pretty good friends with them. But when my brother said, I think I'm gay, my first reaction was, I thought it was a choice. Mm-hmm. And my reaction, at the age of 22, knowing absolutely nothing, except there were, I knew there were homosexual people, but I knew nothing else, was, oh, you don't want to be gay. Nobody's going to want to be around you. And that's what I told him. And now, you know, this relationship is healed a long time ago, but at that time, that was what I told him. And I told him out of sympathy and caring, because I really believed it in 1968. So that's how things were.
Les Slotsky, I just want to say I saw a headline that said the fight for gay rights is over.
And I thought, that's interesting.
Yeah, probably because of, you know, all the gay pride events going on, say, in New York and everywhere else. But I thought that sounds kind of like famous last words, you know.
Yeah, the civil rights struggle's done, too.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Barack Obama was elected U.S. president, and so that means that there's
and
no
women
more
have
racial prejudice.
And, yeah, I mean, we could do a whole list.
Yeah. And the thing I most thought of is, how about all these junior high and high school students who are suicidal because they're being bullied and rejected and all that because of their sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. But
Jody Hendon, I'm taking human sexuality this summer online, and there was a statistic in there that was talking, and I cannot remember the number for the life of me, I do apologize, but there's a statistic in there about how that, you know, gay people, queer people of various stripes and colors, the people that they don't feel safe coming out to is to their family members. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's just, I mean, you know, even today, you know, that's like the saddest thing that you can think of. It's like, you know, you're safe to come out to your school, to your work, to your everything, but you're to your, you know, to your family of creation, whatever, you know, your friends, whatever, but you can't come out to your mom, you can't come out to your dad, and those are the people that are supposed to love you the most in the whole wide world. So.
Ann Cowan, just a comment. My family is probably the whitest, most middle-class, boring lineage ever. And so when my granddaughter announced that she was a lesbian a few years ago, the overwhelming response from everyone, aunts, uncles, parents, cousins, everybody was, thank goodness, some diversity.
Bryce Hobrog. I had a good friend in New York City for a time. He was an assistant city commissioner of the state of New York, and he was a native Kansan, and he was searching for a university in Kansas who would invite him to come and give a lecture or two based on his experience in city government. And the fact is, he was chairman of the New York State Liberal Party, who elected John Lindsay back in the day. You know, you old guys will remember this. He was actually very prominent, a very nice fellow. And it came to me because the political science department here at K-State wouldn't talk to him. Nobody here, I was the only one who talked to him and consider this what he wanted to do. We went to New York City one time, Shirley and I and the kids, and we extended the friendship, and he explained his family history. He was born in Paola, Kansas, and he said, my father didn't like me. And when I graduated from high school, he put me in the car and took me to Kansas City and dumped me out on the street and said, I never want to see you again. Well, he walked into Kansas City Public Library and got a job right away, and he made his way and got a bachelor's degree from the University of Missouri. Well, it was Kansas City University at the time. And the day he graduated, he got on the bus again and went to New York City and walked into the New York Public Library and got a job, which he pursued until he got his bearings with the city and rose to prominence in city government and with the liberal New York State Liberal Party. Well, the whole thing lapsed. He didn't pursue it, and I did. But I asked him, did you ever see your father again? And he said, yeah, when he died, I went back and attended his funeral, but we never communicated thereafter. But the circumstances of this are so obvious. What was going on with the fellow? And you could follow it step by step in his life in New York City even. So I'll leave it at that for the moment.
Hello, I'm Kathy Swenson, and I don't have any stories, but I just some pondering that your message today, John Alou, the center, and where does change come from, and how fear interferes with it, and how people at the center have the most to lose, and how you change. Those things are playing around in my brain. And I'm also, because I'm reading something about the Holocaust again, which I do a lot, thinking of the fear that some of the Germans who should have been knowing what was going on but hid their eyes from everything and did not help, and the ones that did help, and how different. Why? Why are some people brave and some people not? That's just questions I are going through my head, and how I react to everything, because I know there's many faults in my cultural upbringing, and it just, not that I wasn't born into a very pretty liberal family, but just culture itself, what it does to people and how it hurts and how it changes people's lives from what they could have been to something that accepts just something, thinking normal, this is normal. So what is normal? Nothing is. So, okay, just some ideas that are going through my head. Thank you for your message.
Jimmy Bridges, I was also just piggybacking off of that point on the center. As someone who has almost all identities that someone would consider the center, I'm recently putting a few thoughts together about my own cultural upbringing and how society influences me, and I guess coming to the realization that I'm never gonna get it to where I'm never gonna be no longer influenced by homophobia, no longer influenced by racism, no longer influenced by transphobia, classism, ableism. It's there's never going to be a time where that stuff is not going to get into me. And so that personal self-work that I feel like I'm doing, I feel like I'm on the right track with, I'm always going to have to be vigilant to deconstruct and to rid myself of racism, of homophobia, of transphobia, because that's the society we live in that those things perpetuate. And this is just a recent realization that it's never going to end. It's going to continue. That work needs to continue.
Hi, Amy Betts. I'll sit down while I talk. I just wanted to tell everyone how important I think it is, and I'll give you some stories, to really think about it as LGBTQIA+, and how important all those letters are to so many people. I was recently sitting down with a student of mine who identifies as asexual, and she was talking about how painful it is that there are people she knows that are more than willing to accept gays and lesbians, mm-hmm. but the second she says that she's asexual, they will say things like, well, you just haven't met the right person yet. And then so I was talking to her about this, and somehow that can be just so painful, right? And I was telling her, I personally actually identify as bisexual, and I've had a lot of the same experiences, because mm-hmm. the first thing I get, well, that can't really be true. You're married to a man. And in the way that it just sort of casts all of this off, right? And in many ways, it is nice. I am very privileged in that I get to choose who I tell this information to, because no one's going to assume anything about me. But just how quickly a single person's action can sort of dismiss this idea that, you know, I quit lacrosse my senior year in high school because I was just... and told everyone it was because I wanted to spend more time with my boyfriend. Well, it was I wanted to spend more time with my boyfriend to prove to myself I wasn't gay, right? And that these people, they don't really understand how there's similarity, but there's differences. And so in this conversation I was having with my student, she was also mentioning how difficult it's been for her to connect with things like women's rights movements and with other women about that, because she was taking a gender studies course. And they were talking about the women's rights movement is also about sexuality and women's mm-hmm. sexuality. And they had to do this reading, and it was women talking about how they deserve the right to good sex and how that's such a part of the... And she just couldn't identify... And she actually mm-hmm. felt it very painful that if she wasn't also working towards these things or didn't care about these things, that she somehow wasn't fighting for women. And I think it is really important to try and... think about all the different ways that these different identities, I mean, it can be overwhelming, right? But it does really affect and influence lots of people in different ways.
That is a perfect setup for how I want to close. Those of us who have not always been sure we were welcome need to be reminded that we belong. And those of us who have never questioned that we belong need to be reminded that there must be space for everyone else. And so one way to embrace that radical inclusivity is to say flat out without reservation, you belong. And so this morning I want to end by doing a little litany that I've adapted from the Center for Action and Contemplation. And your part in this is simple. After each group that I name, after each set of groups that I name, I invite you to say, we say you belong. Let's practice.
We say you belong.
All right. People on all parts of the continuum of sexual orientation, including those who are gay, bisexual, lesbian, heterosexual, pansexual, asexual, queer, sexually active, celibate, and everyone for whom those labels don't apply,
we say you belong.
People on all parts of the continuum of gender identity and expression, transgender, cisgender, male, female, intersex, butch, femme, androgynous, gender nonconforming, gender fluid, gender queer, and everyone for whom those labels don't apply,
we say you belong.
People of African descent, of Asian descent, of European descent, of Middle Eastern descent, of South American and Latin American descent, of First Nations descent in this land and abroad, and people of mixed and multiple descents and of all languages spoken,
we say you belong.
Bodies with all abilities and challenges, those living with any chronic medical condition, visible or invisible, mental or physical, we say you belong. People who identify as activists and those who don't. Mystics, believers, seekers of all kinds, people of all ages, those who support you to be here. We say you belong. Your emotions, joy, fear, grief, contentment, disappointment, surprise, anger, pride, and all else that flows through you, we say you belong. Your families, genetic and otherwise, those dear of us who have died, our ancestors and the future ones, the ancestors who lived in this land, in this place where these buildings are now, we honor you through this work. We say you belong. People who feel broken, lost, struggling, who suffer from self-doubt and self-judgment, and people with steady confidence, we say you belong. All beings who inhabit this earth, human or otherwise, the two-legged, the four-legged, winged and finned, those that walk, fly, and crawl above the ground and below, in air and water, we say you belong. It is indeed a rainbow world more gorgeous than monochrome. May it always be so. And our final song has a backstory. Harvey Milk, a gay activist, was elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in 1977. Less than a year later, Dan White, a former supervisor and political opponent, killed Milk, along with Mayor George Moscone. The devastated LGBTQ community poured into the streets in sadness and anger. And that was the moment that a singer-songwriter popular in the lesbian feminist community, Holly Neer, wrote this song. And recently she said about it, "I wrote this song when Harvey Milk and George Moscone were assassinated. We originally sang We Are Gay and Lesbian together. But then we were surrounded by the support of allies, and so I changed it to We Are Gay and Straight Together. And now we're learning more and more about gender and sexuality, and now it requires many more syllables than I can fit into the song. And so we sing We Are All in This Together. And I appreciate the challenge that all our many identities present to stanchion. That is, having the proper number of syllables in a song line. However, since we are celebrating Stonewall today, we're going to sing the gay and straight verse, remembering that we have only moments ago acknowledged that everyone belongs. Okay? All right.
Singing for our love.
leave you with words from Christopher Rothbauer. May our lives be reflections of the beauty, peace, and joy that is possible in the world. And may the love we find in this place sustain us as we go our separate ways. Amen.